Welcome back to The Path Went Chilly for part two of our series of episodes about the unsolved disappearance of Jeremy Bright. Robin, so you want to catch everyone up with what we were discussing last week?
Well, this took place in August of 1986 in a small town called Myrtle Point, Oregon, and the victim was 14-year-old Jeremy Bright, who lived in another town with his single mother and his younger sister, Esty. Because Jeremy had grown up in Myrtle Point, he wanted to go back there to attend the annual summer fair, so his mother agreed to let him and his sister stay there for a week, and they would be staying with her ex-husband, their former stepfather. And one day, Jeremy was helping out some of his relatives, and he let Esty hang out at the fair alone with her friend, and told her that he would meet her at the Ferris wheel at around 5 p.m. He gave a call to his mother at 4:45 saying that he was going to meet Esty, but he never showed up and has not been seen ever since. When his mother finally traveled to Myrtle Point, she reported him missing, and a whole bunch of different rumors would circulate about a group of local town bullies who may have done something to Jeremy, and they included him possibly going to a party and having a beer that was laced with a drug that caused him to overdose, or him going with some friends to a swimming hole and these boys trying out a gun for target practice and accidentally shooting him. And then when they tried to nurse Jeremy back to health at a remote cabin, he wound up dying, so they disposed of his body. But the only verified fact is that one of these people who kept popping up in these rumors showed up at an apartment building later that on the night Jeremy went missing, covered in blood, and would not explain where it came from. And then shortly thereafter, a friend of Jeremy's named Johnny went to see his sister, and he was obviously very traumatized about something, but never spoke about what actually happened. But a lot of people speculate that he personally witnessed what happened to Jeremy. It might have been the key to this case, but sadly, Johnny has since passed away. And a couple of years later, one of the prime suspects in this case, named Terry Lee Steinhoff, he went to prison for an unrelated murder. There had been a lot of rumors that he had been seen around Jeremy on the day he went missing, and he had a reputation for causing trouble in the area, but he refused to talk about the case, and he died of a heroin overdose in prison. But it's been suspected that there are at least two or three people involved in what happened to Jeremy, but they've all managed to remain silent for 36 years, and this case is still unsolved. So if you research this case, there seems to be some confusion about the exact timeline of events on the day Jeremy went missing, and it's possible that the Unsolved Mystery segment contains inaccurate information. Their version is that at around 4:45 p.m., Jeremy stopped at a payphone to call his mother to arrange for her to come pick him up in 2 days. Then at around 9:40 p.m., Jeremy stopped by his uncle's tavern to borrow some money from his former stepfather, Ole, and this was the last confirmed sighting of him. The segment never mentions anything about Jeremy not showing up at the fair for his planned meeting with his sister, Esty, at the Ferris wheel at 5 p.m. In fact, aside from a brief mention of Jeremy having a sister, Esty is not featured at all during the Unsolved Mystery segment. I'm guessing this omission might have been intentional, as Esty was only 9 years old at the time, and perhaps they didn't want her being mentioned on the show in order to protect her identity. But all the subsequent media accounts of this case state that Jeremy stopped by the tavern shortly after his phone call while he was on the way to the fairgrounds, and that version makes more sense to me. If Jeremy went to the tavern at 9:40, then this would mean he missed his scheduled meetup with Esty and made no attempt to find her during the next 5 hours, which sounds very out of character for him. I guess it's possible that Jeremy could have simply forgotten about her, but since he specifically mentioned that he was on his way to meet Esty during his final phone call with Diane, that seems unlikely. So we have to assume that something happened to Jeremy during a very narrow window of time between 4:45 and 5 o'clock.
That's exactly where my gut goes here. You have a 14-year-old brother who's told his 9-year-old sister, make sure you meet me here at 5. I'm going to come get you. Then he's telling his mom, who's put him in this very important position to watch out for his little sister, hey, I'm running back to the fair to grab Esty and our friend. And then he just doesn't show up. Like, I don't see him going to a swimming hole. I don't see him going and getting in the truck with somebody. I don't see him just, you know, frolicking around town, going to a party and drinking. None of that makes sense. And that's the only reason I'm almost driven to say, did he get apprehended by someone who's a passerby? Was he picked up while he was walking back to the fair? Like, what happened to Jeremy? And what I do believe is that 15-minute window where he left the payphone and didn't show up at 5 o'clock like he had promised many people.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, that he just happened to cross paths with the wrong people during that very narrow window of time. And the detail about him showing up at the tavern at 9:40, I've actually heard that Unsolved Mysteries would sometimes intentionally drop false pieces of information into their segment in order to weed out false tips. And this could have been done just in case someone came forward and said that, I saw Jeremy at such and such a place at this time. But if they still think that the 9:40 time at the tavern is accurate, that means the information is not good. So that might be the reason why there's such a confusion about the timeline.
On the surface, it might seem odd that when Jeremy didn't show up to meet her, Esty didn't say anything about it for the next 2 days. She did immediately attempt to speak to a police officer at the fairgrounds, who gave her the standard response, "Oh, don't worry, he's probably off with friends, I'm sure he'll turn up soon." So Esty probably figured she'd see Jeremy again before too long. What seems even more unusual is that Jeremy could be missing for 2 straight days, and Ole, a grown adult who was supposed to be taking care of him, did nothing about it until Diane arrived. In fact, since Jeremy's wallet, keys, and wristwatch were found inside Ole's house, it's tempting to believe that perhaps Ole had something to do with his disappearance. But we mentioned in our previous episode that Diane has made a number of posts on the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the sitcom's online forum, and she did address the situation. Apparently, Ole's job as a logger required him to get up and leave for work sometime between 3 and 4 a.m., and he was working on both days Jeremy was missing. So when Ole woke up on the morning on August 15th, the day after Jeremy was last seen, he would have just assumed Jeremy was sleeping. If Ole woke up that early, then he probably also went to bed early, so there would have been no reason for him to be alarmed if he returned home on the 15th and Jeremy wasn't there. Now, Ole apparently confirmed that he did notice Jeremy was not at his home when he woke up for work during the early morning hours of the 16th, but just assumed that Jeremy was spending the night at a friend's place. Again, that might seem unusual today, but this took place in a small town during an era where kids had a lot more independence, so we can understand why Ole might not have been immediately concerned. Sadly, Ole passed away in 2003, but he was always guilt-ridden about Jeremy's disappearance.
You know, and Esty wasn't concerned either, really. I mean, it was kind of like, well, he didn't show up. I told the police they weren't concerned. My mom's on her way in a day. So she wasn't really overly concerned or we're not told that she went and talked to Ole and said, "Hey, Jeremy's not here. I need Jeremy." She probably thought, well, he didn't come pick me up. He's hanging out with his friends. She's enjoying this rare trip back to be with her old friends. So I feel like it's just one of those kind of lazy days and waiting for mom to get there. And there wasn't a whole lot of concern, especially after Esty was told by the police, "Don't worry about it."
Exactly. It is kind of odd that Esty didn't see Ole at any point during those 2 days and casually mentioned to him, "By the way, I haven't seen Jeremy during this time period." But again, it might just be the timeline where Ole had to get up super early to work and was rarely at the house. And when he did come back home, he went to bed early. So I guess it's possible that he didn't see Esty at all during those 2 days, but assumed she was okay because she could have spent the time hanging around with her aunt, her uncle, or her grandmother.
I just think it's odd that it wasn't brought up during a conversation at some point. Like, they must have crossed paths sometime during those couple days. If it alarmed Esty enough that she brought it up to the police at the carnival, you would think that she would have brought it up to Ole and said, "Hey, like, have you seen my brother? Because I haven't seen him and he didn't meet me there." And do we know if she had any of these conversations, like, during that time period with any other family members?
We don't know that, unfortunately. Like, I'm very curious that she would at least mention that Jeremy was missing to some of her other family members, but I'm not entirely sure what her whereabouts were, but it did say that when Jeremy didn't show up, she went home with the friend that she was with, so maybe she just spent those 2 days staying at her friend's house and just didn't speak to anyone from her family and assumed that Jeremy would turn up eventually. I used to be confused about the fact that Jeremy's wallet, keys, and wristwatch were found inside Ole's home. Since Jeremy seemed to go missing while he was in town, I couldn't understand why he would return to the house and leave those items there, especially when he was supposed to be meeting his sister. But there's a simple explanation for that. Jeremy just never took those items with him to begin with. Diane pretty much confirmed this during one of her message board posts, as Jeremy was still a relatively young age and not used to carrying a wallet, so he had a habit of leaving it at home. In fact, that might explain why he asked to borrow money from Ollie at the tavern right before he disappeared. And since the keys belonged to his family's apartment in Grants Pass, there really wouldn't be any reason for Jeremy to take them with him. So I think the presence of these items does not indicate that Jeremy returned to Ollie's house at any point on August the 14th. This supports the idea that something happened to Jeremy almost immediately after he left his uncle's tavern and before he reached the fairgrounds to meet up with his sister. Under different circumstances, I might be able to chalk up Jeremy's disappearance to a stranger abduction. If you go to the Charlie Project, you'll find a number of cases featured there in which children or teenagers have gone missing after attending a fair or a carnival. Given the transient nature of the profession, there are a number of documented cases where carnival workers turned out to be serial killers and used that position in order to lure young victims. But I have my doubts that's what happened in this case, as it seems far more likely that one or more individuals from the community whom Jeremy may have known personally were responsible for what happened to him.
If you do go down that stranger route, though, because we talked about that briefly on the last episode, if it was a stranger or a passerby, what a better place to kidnap a young person than at a county fair? And there are people coming and going. There are cars and people and faces that you haven't seen normally because they're coming and going to this little town for the fair. So, I mean, it is possible that someone was targeting this area looking for children. And remember, this was Kids Day. So what a eerie, like, I mean, that makes me almost nauseous when I think about, oh, it's Kids Day. That would have been highly publicized. And if there was a predator, what a better day to visit the fair.
Exactly. I've seen so many profile pages in the Charlie Project where they'll mention that they went missing while attending a fair and were last seen in the presence of a worker who later went to prison for several other murders. So it's kind of creepy to know how many people like used a carnival worker as a cover to murder people.
And I guess they've got a lot of trailers there and stuff too. So if you were going to just snatch and grab a kid, you could probably find somewhere to hide them for like a short term until later disposing of them in some manner. And I'm sure that's obviously what happened in all those other cases that you're talking about, Robin, because it's such a nightmare to think you go somewhere where it's supposed to be the most fun for kids. You know, you get to go play games and ride on rides, win prizes, eat fun food. And then to think that there's like a predator lurking around who's just looking for the opportunity to take a child is just so disconcerting.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, it could be anyone. It could be someone who literally lives, you know, in a town nearby or is one of those people who travels a lot. And they said, oh, this little town's having a kid's day at the carnival and I'm a predator. Or it could have been like what Robin said, someone who worked at the fair. But if there's that 15-minute window that Jeremy snagged, and he would have likely been close to the fairgrounds when he was walking in to get his sister. I mean, oof, it definitely does open up that stranger abduction story more because of that kind of location versus if he was just running to grab his sister at the store or something like that.
The Unsolved Mysteries segment presented two possible scenarios for Jeremy's disappearance, which were both fueled by rumors which had spread throughout the town and involved him being the victim of an accidental death, which was covered up. One of the rumors was that Jeremy attended a party and drank a beer which had been laced with an illegal drug and may have caused a potential overdose. Multiple witnesses apparently placed Jeremy at one or more parties in the town that week, though it doesn't sound like there was anything to substantiate the overdose story. This theory would have been reminiscent, as Ashley brought up earlier, of the Kurtsova case, which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, only a few months before Jeremy's case, and of course it's been covered on both The Trail Went Cold and The Path Went Chilly. As you might recall, Kurtsova was another teenage boy who went missing after supposedly attending a party, and his body was found in a vacant lot 5 days later. While they could never conclusively determine how exactly Kurt died, the most prevalent theory is that Kurt's death was a result of a negative reaction to drugs or alcohol, and the people who hosted the party covered the whole thing up by attempting to nurse him back to health and disposing of his body after he passed away. The same scenario could have easily happened to Jeremy, especially since he had a heart murmur, which could have led to fatal consequences if he ingested the wrong thing. On the surface, it doesn't sound like an implausible explanation, as Jeremy was only 14 years old and not used to drinking alcohol, so I could see some jerks thinking it might be a funny prank to slip a drug into one of his drinks.
For sure. There was actually a case where I live where a young 23-year-old was drinking beers with friends, and all of a sudden he just died in this bar. And one of the rumors around town was that his buddies thought it would be funny to make him be like the clown of the night by slipping him a drug, but something interacted, right? Whether it was pre-existing health conditions or something with the drug itself. But everyone knew everybody there and they were handing him drinks. And so that was definitely a plausible scenario. I could see Jeremy, a 14-year-old, being someone that people said, hey, we could make him just do crazy fun things if he was high as a kite too. And then all of a sudden going, oh my God, something happened. However, that rumor includes that he's hanging out with friends and he's at this party and not a single soul came forward to say, hey, we were drinking. Hey, I saw him here. Hey, we were with these people at a point where you think your friend is missing. Like no one would come forward.
The utter vagueness is really disturbing. It feels like we've got a piece of the story, but we don't have the whole thing. And it seems like there should have been some eyewitness at this party. There's only, what, like 2,400 people in this city or in this town? It's tiny. Like you said, Ash, Reagan knows everybody, and Reagan hasn't even lived there that long, right? So
yeah, oh my God, we're new to the town. We've been there a year and a half, and everyone knows everything about my life. They know everything about my daughter's life, and I know things I wish I didn't know about there. So, you know, that's just how a small town works, and it's instant. I mean, when you're part of a community like that, you're part of it, whether you like it or not. And these kids had just moved away and were getting to come back. So I feel like there would have been a lot of excitement and attention around them between their family and the friends that they had to say goodbye to just a couple of months earlier. But they're back and they're having fun. And then all of a sudden, Jeremy's gone.
At least with the Kurt Sova case, we had independent eyewitnesses who said, I was there at the party with him, I saw him get drunk, so we knew that he was at least there. But here it's mostly like, oh, we heard Jeremy was at a party and may have drank a beer with an illegal drug in it, but this was never substantiated. There was no one who actually came forward and said, I saw Jeremy drinking, I saw him have a bad reaction to this drug. So it sounds like we said in our last episode, like a game of telephone that got out of control. The big issue with this theory is that Jeremy had a scheduled meetup with Esty at the fair. If Jeremy decided to attend a party instead, then this would mean he completely stood up his younger sister, which sounded pretty uncharacteristic of him. However, I think it's worth mentioning that while Jeremy was ordinarily a very good, responsible kid, his grades had slipped a little bit after his family moved from Myrtle Point to Grants Pass. It seemed like he might have been having a difficult time adjusting to his mother's divorce and having to move to a new town and started a new school. So investigators couldn't discount the possibility that after returning to Myrtle Point for the week, without his mother and reuniting with old friends, Jeremy may have decided to cut loose and do some irresponsible things he ordinarily wouldn't have done, even if it meant abandoning his sister. But I don't think he would have mentioned meeting up with Esty during his final phone call to his mother unless he planned on following through. I think the witnesses who recalled seeing Jeremy at some parties may have been telling the truth, but they were just mistaken about the exact date. Remember, parties were taking place throughout Myrtle Point throughout the entire week of the fair, so perhaps Jeremy was seen at parties which took place prior to August the 14th.
If he was going to go to a party, it's 4:45. He's supposed to pick her up at 5. There is not a need for that 15 minutes to be so urgent to get to that party. If I'm at all accurate, I would think that Jeremy would go pick up Esty, get her home, and then go to a party at 5:15. Why would you abandon your little sister and her friend who you just confirmed you're going to get? You're responsible for, you know, your stepfather can't help her, and just completely ignore your responsibility to her. I don't buy it. I think at 4:45, he had every intention to go get her. What he planned to do after he got her and took her home, I don't know. But I don't think leaving and abandoning her was part of the plan.
I agree 100%. It doesn't sound at all like Jeremy. And I mean, what kind of party starts at 4:45? I get when you're an adult, sometimes people will do day drinking and parties, but like, what type of parents, you know, in the community would be allowing all of the kids to be getting together, starting drinking at 4:45? These are teenagers, 14-year-olds. Can you imagine how annihilated they would be come like 8 p.m.? I just think back to high school and I think of when most parties would start, and it would usually be like, you know, 8 or 9 o'clock.
Sounds like the type of party that Oli would have, because he had to get up at 3 or 4 a.m. yeah. to go logging. So he goes to a 4:45 party and then is in bed by 8 p.m.
Of course, the other major rumor presented on Unsolved Mysteries is that Jeremy was accidentally shot at a local swimming hole by three troublemakers who were showing off by firing a gun into the water. Jeremy eventually succumbed to his wounds and his body was buried somewhere. During our interview, Diane stated that out of all the rumors she heard, she really hoped this one wasn't true, because it would have meant that Jeremy had to suffer for 2 weeks before he died. Like Robin mentioned earlier, the Unsolved Mysteries reenactments of a wounded Jeremy slowly bleeding to death in a desolate cabin and the perpetrators carrying his body through the dark woods are incredibly unsettling. But it's worth reiterating that the cabin and the surrounding area were searched by investigators, and they never found Jeremy or any evidence to support this story. And of course, the primary source was a jailhouse informant, who were not known for being the most reliable individuals in the world. I do think there might be some elements of truth in the story, as we mentioned earlier, but I'm not sure Jeremy would have specifically been shot at a swimming hole. Again, it just doesn't ring true that Jeremy would blow off a meeting with his sister in order to go swimming somewhere. They also made it sound like Jeremy was swimming with several friends when this incident happened. But as far as I know, no one has ever talked or corroborated this story. And that's the central problem here. All these rumors seem to have been shared by people who heard them somewhere, but none of them personally witnessed these alleged events take place. The only eyewitness who may have actually seen something incriminating is Jeremy's friend Johnny, but we'll talk about him in a moment. For now, I think it would be a good time to discuss the individual who many believe to be the prime suspect, Terry Lee Steinhoff.
Now, before we get to that, I've got to go back to what Diane said, that she prays that was not true, that Jeremy wasn't sitting there suffering for weeks and being held when he could have been being taken care of at a hospital or something like that. This is what I'm talking about when I say these cases are the most tragic, that Diane can't put that narrative to rest, because without knowing what happened, she can't say that that didn't happen to Jeremy. So it's that missing person status, that lack of recovery of a body of her son, that does cause her to say, you know, as crazy as this story is, or as horrific as this story is, as heartbreaking as this version is, all of those are possibilities. And it's something that is nearly impossible to turn off in that cycle in her brain. So it breaks my heart for her that she has to even say those words. I'm hoping that's not what happened to him. You know, she doesn't have a body to have any kind of evidence of what did happen to her son. So, gosh, my heart breaks when I hear people, especially a mama who's talking about her baby and not knowing what happened. All right, give me the scoop on this Terry Lee Steinhoff, who all I know right this second is that he's a murderer and he is not a, quote, upstanding member of society or strong pillar in the society.
Oh, yes. I mean, we definitely know that Terry Lee Steinhoff committed a brutal murder less than 2 years after Jeremy went missing, so he's clearly a bad guy. And Steinhoff does have a personal connection to Jeremy since he babysat him when he was younger. So let's assume that Jeremy crossed paths with Steinhoff while he was on his way to meet Esty. There were apparently several witnesses who placed Jeremy and Steinhoff in a truck together that day, though it's unclear when exactly these sightings took place. Steinhoff might have convinced Jeremy to go somewhere with him, and if he was forceful or intimidating enough, Jeremy might have agreed to do so even if he was supposed to be meeting his sister. Another source of confusion is that the last time Esty remembered seeing Jeremy, he was speaking with two guys she didn't recognize. Again, it's not clear when exactly this took place. Was this at around 2 p.m. when Jeremy and Esty went their separate ways? Or did Esty happen to catch a glimpse of Jeremy with these two guys closer to 5 o'clock? If Esty saw her brother speaking to two guys at 2 o'clock, then this might not have had much significance, since Jeremy spent most of the afternoon working with his aunt at a restaurant. I'm not sure if either of those guys Esty saw would have been Steinhoff, as he used to babysit the Bright family, so she may have been able to recognize him. Steinhoff's father was apparently a feared individual in the community, and according to one of Estee's posts on the Unsolved Mysteries message board, when he passed away, a detective attempted to question the father about Jeremy's case on his deathbed, and he said he would, quote-unquote, not rat out his son.
Oh, that's creepy. I feel sorry for Estee, too. You know, she's sitting here trying to say, I don't really remember. Like, I saw him. I can't remember what time it was. Remember, she was 9 years old when this happened. So, and she is in this overstimulated, exciting place where she's just trying to figure out how to get tickets to her rides, when she's going to be back at that Ferris wheel, all the good foods and toys she's going to be getting and playing all the games. And then she's asked to remember these critical details about her brother, which could be key to what happened to him. I just can't fathom the amount of stress that she'd be under.
We previously mentioned that Cecilia Fish also left a few comments on the Unsolved Mysteries message board, and she confirmed that the man she saw in the apartment building covered in blood was not actually Steinhoff, but Steinhoff's cousin. Cecilia did report this incident to the police, but when they questioned this cousin, he claimed that the blood on him was from scratches he received during a fight with his girlfriend. However, Cecilia maintains that the amount of blood that she saw was way too large to have been caused by scratches. There's some additional confusion with the timeline here, as during her Unsolved Mysteries interview, Cecilia said that this incident took place on Friday night, which would have been August 15th, the day after Jeremy was last seen. Investigators seem to believe that Jeremy died on August 14th. So if the blood seen on this guy's shirt was connected to the case, it's odd that he would still be wearing it around in public an entire day later. Also, the fact that Johnny showed up at his sister's apartment a half hour later and was completely freaked out seems to indicate that whatever he witnessed had taken place very recently.
Think about the last time you were scratched. I can't really recall a time where a scratch or even a cut led to much bleeding that would cause everyone else around me to have significant trauma or to remember being covered in blood. I also am very bothered by the fact that he laughed. I remember when you first read this description to me, he laughed and said, oh, I got this hours ago. Ha ha ha. And he's covered in blood. Like, what a psychopath. And Cecilia remembers it very clearly. And then, like you said, you know, a few minutes later, Johnny's running up to the apartment and is so overwhelmed and traumatized and wasn't the same after that night. So did something happen? Where's Johnny today? After the passing of Steinhoff, it seemed like someone would have come forward and said, hey, I know some information. He can't touch me now. But remember, his family was also supposedly very dangerous. So if it was Steinhoff, would remaining family members be threats to those who knew what happened?
I thought it was so weird how Steinhoff's cousin had said, oh, this happened hours ago, as if when it happened was more interesting than why it happened. I mean, it just seems like a really bizarre way to respond to something like that. Like, why are you wearing a shirt covered in blood and then to laugh it off? And that very volume of blood, like you said, Ash, the only time I ever get a tiny cut and it bleeds a lot is from my razor.
Yep. I was just thinking shaving my legs.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, when you nick your leg and you're like, oh crap, that is a bleeder. But, you know, I've been scratched by a cat before. And I remember holding my little brother and sister when they were little and they had those scratchy little baby nails. And you get those little scratches, but they don't bleed. You're not going to bleed from a bunch of scratches unless somebody has literal razor blades on the end of their fingers.
By the way, if you go back and watch the Unsolved Mysteries set of reenactment of the scene, the actor that they cast to play Steinhoff's cousin has a killer mullet. He looks like your typical, like, 1980s bully with a mullet and a tank top and just the way he's asking, going, oh, this happened hours ago. So you're watching him and it's like, oh, I can have no trouble believing that this guy was responsible for Jeremy's disappearance.
Gotta love a good mullet.
Mm-hmm. Everyone has always suspected that Johnny was the key to figuring out what happened to Jeremy. But whatever took place proved so traumatizing that Johnny just could not reveal what he knew. I'm really not quite sure how Johnny would have gotten mixed up in this. The Unsolved Mysteries episode gives off the impression that Jeremy and Johnny were hanging out at the fair together on the same day Jeremy went missing, but we know that Jeremy spent most of that afternoon working at his aunt's restaurant. And Johnny was not with Jeremy when he stopped by the tavern to see Ollie, which is the last confirmed sighting of him. So did the two friends cross paths while Jeremy was on his way to the fairgrounds to meet Esty? Perhaps Johnny was hanging out with Steinhoff and his cronies at that time, which is how they convinced Jeremy to go off somewhere with them. This could have led to one of the rumored scenarios where Steinhoff was firing off a gun for target practice and Jeremy was accidentally shot, or it could have led to something a lot more disturbing.
Or it also could have been, like you said earlier, that Johnny and Jeremy were seen hanging out multiple days at the fair or being together on different dates. And that this day, because Jeremy was working with his aunt, because he was going to get his sister, maybe he and Johnny weren't together, or were they? You know, like, did Johnny distract Jeremy? Did Steinhoff distract Jeremy and Johnny was around? It's almost as if Johnny holds the key or is the person that needs to be talked to in this case, because what did you see that day that made you upset? What are you afraid of? What do you recall from a case so long ago that really seemed to have defined part of your life?
You can only imagine what Cecilia Fish was thinking, because this is like a half hour after she saw Steinhoff's cousin coming into her apartment covered with blood, and then only a half hour later, Johnny shows up all traumatized, so you feel that they have to be connected, but Johnny just cannot or will not say what actually happened.
It's too bad that Johnny is deceased as well as Steinhoff, because between the two of them, I feel like they definitely had the answer to what happened. Well, in addition to posting at the Unsolved Mysteries message board, Estes also posted in a thread about Jeremy's case in the Web Sleuths forum and shared another disturbing story, which has floated around about what happened. According to this rumor, Jeremy and Johnny were both taken into the woods to be victimized, which we're sure is probably another term for sexual assault, and Jeremy was murdered after he threatened to talk about what happened. Again, this is just a rumor which was spread, and we have no idea if it has any basis in reality, but if true, you can certainly understand why Johnny was left so traumatized. Like we mentioned earlier, Johnny was never the same after this, and he was apparently plagued by nightmares and lived a self-destructive lifestyle until his death in 2011. From what has been posted about him, it sounds like Johnny was able to remember things up to a certain point before he blacked out. So whatever happened might have been so awful that he completely blocked it from his memory.
How sad. That's trauma 101. Our brain does miraculous things to help us prevent, further traumatization, further distress. It allows you to kind of block out some of those memories. But oh my God, until you read this paragraph, I'm sitting there going, what happened? This is definitely a possibility. Remember, this is the 80s. In 2023, this is crazy, it's 2023. In 2023, men still struggle to be validated and heard and, able to share their story of sexual abuse. And this is in the 80s. So had Johnny and Jeremy been sexually abused by individuals, particularly other men or boys, then no wonder Johnny wouldn't feel like he could come forward, right? Whether he wouldn't be believed, whether his masculinity would have been questioned, whether he would have been blamed for the abuse, all of those things would go into a scenario like that. Sexual abuse is, to me, one of the most horrific things that could happen to an individual. So Johnny being so overwhelmed, both in the moment and for the rest of his life, without therapy, without support, that's very plausible. It's also very plausible that if Jeremy said, you wait till I get home, I will tell everyone what you did, that he was killed. And if that was the case, Johnny's going, my only way to live through this nightmare is to keep my mouth shut.
I mean, we mentioned earlier how horrible this has to be for Diane and the rest of Jeremy's family to hear all these rumors and not know if any of them are true. Like, we thought that the whole Jeremy being wounded and slowly dying in the cabin was bad enough. But now we have a separate rumor about him and Johnny potentially being sexually assaulted. And again, we don't know if it's true, but for Diane to even have to hear this has to be so traumatizing. And I do not think it's implausible, because this would definitely explain why Johnny was left so traumatized and why this essentially ruined his life and he was never the same.
To me, this is the most likely scenario, even though it's an unsubstantiated rumor, so are the other two. The idea with the other two, we have to believe, is that Jeremy was going to shirk his responsibility with Esty, whether at some party or whether at a swimming hole. And I just don't believe that to be true. So this explains both what happened to Jeremy, in the sense that he wasn't there in those 15 minutes if somebody or multiple people snagged him. And then it also explains why Johnny would be so traumatized, especially if he himself was a victim, but also if he saw what had happened to Jeremy. I can imagine Steinhoff's family, if he was indeed involved, is super scary. They obviously have some criminals in the family. I mean, when you've got dad saying, "I don't want to rat on my son," on his deathbed, like, that's a scary dude. And especially in saying something like that, it would lead me to believe that he either has insider knowledge or believes that his son did it. Because if his son was innocent, I don't think you would say anything like that. You just would be like, "He had nothing to do with it. Why are you even asking me?"
There's also the fact that Johnny was no longer living in Myrtle Point. He was just visiting there on that particular week. And we know that Steinhoff knew him personally from their childhood. So maybe a scenario where he's like, "Well, he's only going to be in town for a few days. So if we take him into the woods and sexually assault him, he's probably not going to say anything. And he's going to be leaving town anyway. So why don't we take this opportunity to abduct him?" And that could explain why he disappeared during that very narrow window of time before he could pick up his sister.
And Steinhoff babysat kids. That thought terrifies me.
Exactly. When you find out that he, like, murdered Patricia Lynn Morris, and that he may have potentially assaulted Jeremy and Johnny and murdered Jeremy as well, the idea that anyone entrusted him to babysit kids at all, considering his family's bad reputation, is pretty terrifying. If there's one thing I question about the premeditated murder theory, it's the fact that Johnny was even left alive to begin with. If Jeremy's death was an accident, I can see the perpetrators allowing Johnny to live and intimidating him into staying silent. But if Jeremy was killed in cold blood, why not kill Johnny and dispose of his body as well? It seems like quite a risk to leave a living witness behind to a murder, but then again, like we just said, if Johnny was sexually assaulted, maybe they figured the stigma would prevent him from coming forward and speaking about what happened. Sadly, if Johnny knew about Jeremy's fate, he is no longer around to share it, but it's unclear how many other witnesses might know the full truth. During one of her message board posts, Diane revealed that in the years following Jeremy's disappearance, Myrtle Point was hit with another major tragedy when four local teenagers who had been good friends with Jeremy were killed in a car accident. No one can be certain if any of these victims actually knew anything about Jeremy's case, but if they took important information to their graves, this created another major snag in the investigation.
In a case like this, Diane's right. I mean, she's waiting on somebody to have the strength and the courage to say, "I know what happened." And so as she watches the suspects pass away, the friends pass away, the acquaintances pass away, it's that hope gets smaller and smaller that someone's going to be able to communicate this critical information that can lead to some answers for her.
Now, even though we've constantly pointed to Terry Lee Steinhoff as the most likely perpetrator, it must be stated that there's never been any direct evidence that he was responsible for Jeremy's disappearance. We have reported sightings of Jeremy inside Steinhoff's truck, and of course, Cecilia Fish's sighting of Steinhoff's cousin with blood on his clothing. But most of the evidence which implicates them is nothing more than uncorroborated rumors and hearsay. So I can see why no charges were ever filed. Of course, within 2 years, Steinhoff went to prison for another murder. And I can't help but wonder about the timing of Steinhoff's sudden decision to plead no contest to the crime, just one day before the Unsolved Mysteries segment. It sounds like the state would have had a strong circumstantial case against Steinhoff if he went to trial. So I can understand the legal reasoning for his decision. But if you look through old newspaper articles about this case, you can see that the filming of the Unsolved Mysteries segment was a pretty big story in the Coos County area. Even though Steinhoff was never actually referred to by name on the show, he may not have wanted the extra attention of going through a separate murder trial right after Jeremy's case was featured on national television. So this may have motivated his decision to plead no contest and quietly begin serving his sentence in prison. Of course, investigators did try to question him about Jeremy while he was incarcerated, but he didn't cooperate. as I'm sure he feared that being implicated in another murder might jeopardize his chances at parole.
Oh, for sure. I think when you're talking about somebody who's already facing and is charged and then convicted of a crime like murder, and they have a chance for parole, what benefit is it to talk to police? You know, one wrong statement, one wrong word, even if you're innocent, could really put you at risk, right? Could put you in danger because you're a great person to target for other bad things that have occurred over the course of the last several months and years in your area. So I don't blame Steinhoff for not talking, whether he was innocent or guilty. I mean, we don't have a way to know. Again, who knows what happened to Jeremy? This is one of those cases that it's going to take a person to come forward. So Steinhoff's gone, and his family is still likely a name in that community. So I'm wondering if that's been the big thing impeding anyone from being brave enough to come forward.
Well, I keep thinking about the timing of him pleading no contest, because if he had decided to go on trial and the trial was making news throughout the community, and people just watched the Unsolved Mysteries segment and put two and two together and say, hey, this is the same guy who is believed to be responsible for Jeremy's disappearance and he's going to prison for another murder, I need to come forward and talk if I know something. So I can see why he decided to stay out of the spotlight and quietly plead no contest so that he would be already in jail by the time the Unsolved Mysteries case started getting publicity. So it's just kind of unfortunate timing. You would hope that because they knew he was going to be in prison, that people might be compelled to finally share what they knew, but because he had a very powerful and intimidating family, I think that explains why they continue to remain silent.
I'm just shocked that he would be up for parole in 10 years.
Yeah, I think it's just because of the no contest thing, where they figured, well, if he's found guilty, he won't get any parole for 25 years. I guess that was just the sentencing guidelines at the time. When you find out that he, like, stabbed and slashed, like, Patricia Lynn Morris 15 times, that's a guy who probably should not get any opportunity of parole, so that is kind of surprising. I know that when Steinhoff overdosed in 2007, investigators hoped that enough time had passed that people who were fearful of Steinhoff and had important information about Jeremy's case might have felt compelled to come forward. Sadly, this did not occur, but it's worth noting that Steinhoff was not the only suspect. It seems like the most prevalent rumors were that Steinhoff, his cousin, and at least one or two other people were involved with what happened to Jeremy. So even though Steinhoff is now deceased, there are still people out there who could be charged with this crime and lead the authorities to Jeremy's remains. Since they seem to cover their tracks fairly well, I think the key to finally solving this case, if there are any other witnesses who know the full truth but have yet to talk. It seems like most of the rumors in this case were spread by people who had fourth or fifth hand information, but it's unclear how many people out there might have first-hand information which could potentially lead to an arrest if they come forward. It seems like Jeremy's family have reached the point where bringing the perpetrators to justice is not the top priority. I'm sure they would like to attain full closure, but after living with this for over 3 decades, all they really care about is recovering Jeremy's remains and giving him a proper burial. So if you happen to have any information about the unsolved disappearance of Jeremy Bright, please contact the Coos County Sheriff's Office at 541-396-7800. That's 541-396-7800. Jules, Ashley, any final thoughts on this case?
Per the usual, when we talk about these cases, the overwhelming thing that I end with is what this family is going through. You know, we talk about unsolved cases, which creates such a interesting dynamic as far as grief and trauma. It is something where, you know, people have not received a day in court. They have not received what we call, quote, justice. They're never going to get the justice they deserve because their loved one's gone. They're never going to get closure because the person's never going to be alive again. But in this case specifically, and when we talk about a missing person like Jeremy, Diane has no idea what happened to her baby. And worse, she doesn't have the ability to say, just like when I brought him into the world and I was able to keep him safe, I now would like his remains with me so that I can keep him safe as well. That I know these random, bizarre chances that he's still alive, I can put those stories to rest. I can maybe get some answers as to how long did my baby have to suffer and what did he have to endure before his death. But even if I don't get those answers, I know no one's hurting him anymore that his body's not thrown away like trash, that I was able to honor and respect it. So gosh, my prayer is that Diane gets to answer that Esty gets to know she has a place where she can go say hello to her brother and honor her brother, right? Because they've recovered his body. Such a sad case. I feel like there is just one small piece that we need for someone to tell direct information to the police, and those answers would come into reality.
My heart breaks for Esty, for Diane, for Oli, for Jeremy's father, for every family member and friend that loved him and is left with this open-ended grief or trauma. Because the scenarios that were put forth are, you know, like Ashley had said, that Diane would just lay awake kind of and think about all of these different scenarios that could have happened to her baby. And I'm sure Esty did the same, even more so as she became an adult and became very involved in posting about the case. And you're entertaining theories that are like Jeremy was sexually assaulted and then murdered, or Jeremy was shot in a swimming hole and then taken to a cabin and where they tried to nurse him to health for 2 weeks before he succumbed to his injuries and then they disposed of the body, or Jeremy had a fatal drug overdose at a party. These are awful scenarios, every single one of them. And I also think that it is important that, you know, Ashley had brought up at one point that this very well could have been a stranger abduction where somebody associated with the carnival or somebody who was very keenly aware that it was Children's Day at the carnival thought they may have found a minor that didn't have an adult with them that was easy pickings, or perhaps for whatever reason, Jeremy was vulnerable. The person caught them by surprise. I don't think that's likely. I personally think Steinhoff and Steinhoff's creepy cousin with the blood was, this is from a few hours ago. I think they're so sketchy. And then when we couple that with the father who later said, I don't want to rattle my son on his deathbed, it just paints a pretty clear picture for me personally that this family likely was up to some nefarious activities and that they are likely the key to what happened to Jeremy. I just think it's so unfortunate that Johnny was very traumatized by what happened. He blocked it out. He couldn't talk about it, and that he went on to live a life of, you know, trauma and self-destruction. And, you know, addiction is not like a drug problem. It's a trauma problem. And substance abuse disorders in general are. So I think it is just so sad that he isn't with us anymore and that there is no way that he could provide any more details or insights as to what happened. And I really hope that if there is anybody out there who knows any of these concrete details, that they come forward, because clearly the, I don't know what you want to call it, the bad guy landscape has changed and that a lot of these people are deceased now. So any kind of ramifications or retribution that might have been a threat in 1986 no longer is.
Yeah, I mentioned several times before that I watched this on Unsolved Mysteries back in 1989 when it originally aired, and it completely haunted me. Especially the whole reenactment of Jeremy getting shot and being nursed back to health inside that remote dusk, that remote dank cabin, and then having the perpetrators carrying his body out and burying him out in the middle of the woods. And we don't know if that's the truth, but it pretty much shocked me many years later when I read a scenario that it was even more terrifying about the possibility of Jeremy and Johnny being sexually assaulted and Jeremy being murdered when he threatened to talk about it, and that was the reason that Johnny was so traumatized all these years. And like I said, I figured that this one was probably going to be solved relatively quickly, that after I got appearance on national television, someone would come forward with information, because you got the sense that a lot of people in the community knew exactly what happened. Yet here we are all 36 years later, and the prime suspect, Terry Lee Steinhoff, is dead. Johnny is dead, and even though it's suspected that at least one or more two people might be involved in Jeremy's disappearance, I have no idea of their current whereabouts today, and I doubt they have any inclination to talk. So yeah, it's just, it's pretty much one of those cases that brings out the absolute worst nightmare for a victim's family, where they don't know what happened to their missing loved one, but they hear all sorts of nightmarish rumors, and they can never know which one is the full truth. But that's why we keep talking about these cases, though, is that even though a lot of time has passed, even if nobody gets prosecuted or arrested for this crime, all Jeremy's family really wants is to recover his remains. So even if it's just an anonymous tip, someone who knows where Jeremy might be buried, just tell the authorities about it, and at the very least they can get him back and give him a proper burial. But yeah, I definitely think that Terry Lee Steinhoff and some of the other people he was associated with were responsible for Jeremy's death, and it is a travesty that it's still unsolved after all these years.
Robin, do you want to tell us a little bit about the Trail Went Cold Patreon?
Yes, the Trail Went Cold Patreon has been around for 3 years now, and we offer the standard bonus features like early ad-free episodes, and I also send out stickers and signed thank you cards to anyone who signs up with us on Patreon. If you join our $5 tier, tier two, we also offer monthly bonus episodes in which I talk about cases which are not featured on the Trail Went Cold's original feed, so they're exclusive to Patreon. And if you join our highest tier, tier three, the $10 tier, one of the features we offer is a audio commentary track over classic episodes of Unsolved Mysteries, where you can download an audio file and then boot up the original Unsolved Mysteries episode on Amazon Prime or YouTube and play it with my audio commentary playing in the background, where I just provide trivia and factoids about the cases featured in this episode. And incidentally, the very first episode that I did a commentary track over was the episode featuring this case. So if you want to download a commentary track in which I make more smart-ass remarks about Jewel Kaler, then be sure to join Tier 3.
So I want to let you know a little bit about the Jules and Ashley Patreon. So there's early ad-free episodes of The Path Went Chilly. We've got our Path Went Chilly minis, which are always over an hour. So they're not very mini, but they're just too short to turn into a series. And we're really enjoying doing those. So we hope you'll check out those Patreons. We'll link them in the show notes.
So I want to thank you all for listening. And any chance you have to share us on social media with a friend or to rate and review is greatly appreciated. You can email us at thepathwentchilly@gmail.com. You can reach us on Twitter at thepathwent. So until next time, be sure to bundle up because cold trails and chilly paths call for warm clothing.
Music by Paul Rich from the podcast Cold Callers Comedy.